Well, I wanted to basically introduce myself. My name's Greg Juckett. I live in Black Mountain, North Carolina, but for most of my career, I taught global health and tropical medicine at West Virginia University. And I have never served overseas for extended periods of time in the mission field, but I've gone and led mission trips to many malarious areas and have taken all these drugs that I'm going to be talking about and can report to you firsthand on some of the side effects that you might be experiencing. As you know, with malaria, it's a disease that we have predicted would be conquered in our lifetimes. You know, even back in the 70s, they were talking about conquering malaria. Well, the long and the short of it is that they haven't. And the World Health Organization comes up with programs. The latest one is Malaria 2030. And it's always been two steps forward, one step back with malaria. Because for all the lives we've saved with treated bed nets and with these other interventions that we've had, and there have been many great interventions with malaria that have decreased the death toll from over 1 million kids to basically 500,000 kids per year now, 95% of whom die in Africa. The fact is that the resistance that mosquitoes are developing to common insecticides, new types of mosquitoes that are breeding, and the resistance of the parasite itself to the drugs that we've long depended upon for malaria control are now getting away from us. So it's a struggle, and we haven't seen the last of malaria. And I believe that Jesus, the return of Jesus, will probably be the end of malaria, not the World Health Organization. For all their good intentions. I'm behind all what they're doing. So we're going to discuss what's happening with malaria in the world today. Like you, if you're planning to travel abroad, to be able to determine if there's malaria risk at your destination, what species you'll be dealing with, and whether it's going to be a species, principally the falciparum species of malaria, that is likely to kill you. All right, because that's what we worry about. We're going to talk about some non-pharmacological anti-malarial strategies, and there are a lot of them that you can use to help protect yourself. We'll talk about malaria prophylaxis, both short-term, you know, for the short-term trip, and also the more complicated question of what to do for long-term malaria prophylaxis if you're going to be serving in a high-risk country for years. It's always good to know how to self-diagnose and self-treat malaria, at least in its uncomplicated version, because very often when people come back to this country and develop malaria, the doctors don't know enough about the disease to diagnose or treat them. Something I've seen way too much of. So a quarter of the world's population still remains at risk. Mostly these are poor people in the global south. And the African continent has the disproportionate share of the mortality. It's a very serious threat, even today, to children under the age of 5 and to pregnant women. Pregnant women who get malaria often have stillbirth as a consequence of that. And COVID, of course, interrupted our malaria control efforts in 2020. And so we are now trying to catch up with where we were in the malaria control world. Mortality had been slowly dropping due to the successful implementation of bed nets and public health initiatives. And you can see the World Health Organization World Malaria Report from 2022. Unfortunately, there's a new type of mosquito that is threatening all this progress. Its name is Anopheles stephensii. It was initially an Asian species that had a foothold on the Horn of Africa, in East Africa, but is now widely spreading across African cities, and it is becoming a major threat of resurgent malaria across the continent of Africa, particularly in the cities. You may know that malaria has predominantly been a rural disease of Africa, but now it's becoming an urban threat as well. And unfortunately, this mosquito is often pesticide resistant. On top of that, and it can breed in the smallest quantity of water, like a little soda can that has an inch of water in it can breed this mosquito. On the good news, there is a new malaria vaccine called R21 Matrix M malaria vaccine that was developed at Oxford. And it's been approved for prevention in malaria in young children with 3 initial doses and a 1-year booster. And it gives about 80% protection compared to about 45% for the old malaria vaccine, which was the RTS-S vaccine. And so this new vaccine is going to replace that old vaccine, but it's not I directed an international travel clinic, and everybody would come and give me my malaria shot. Well, we don't have a malaria vaccine for you. We do have one to reduce mortality in African kids who are the predominant victims of malaria, but we don't have one for adult travelers. So you cannot get this vaccine. Let's talk a little bit about what malaria is. There are 5 species of human malaria. There are many hundreds of species of animal and bird malarias, by the way. But the one that we need to be concerned about primarily is Plasmodium falciparum. And this is a parasite that feeds on your red blood cells. And this is the overwhelming number of mortality from malaria comes from falciparum malaria. Vivax can kill you, which is the second most common malaria, but it is more of a fluke if that happens. You may have a spleen, enlarged spleen rupture. You feel very sick with Vivax. It's nothing to play around with, but it's the difference between being bitten by a rattlesnake and a copperhead. The former one is going to likely kill you, and the second one probably will not. So I also talk about snake bites, so I have to use that analogy. So 95% of the world's mortality from malaria is from falciparum. The important thing to know about vivax, though, Plasmodium vivax, is that it's common and it can cause relapse. So falciparum just occurs in the blood phase. You get really sick, you may die, but then you get over it. With vivax malaria, it's the gift that keeps on giving because there are always hypnozoites, which is a fancy way of saying sleeper cells that stay in your liver, and it's an adaptation of the parasite to survive winters in its host. And so next spring, the malaria will reseed your blood, you'll get sick again, and mosquitoes that bite you can then transmit malaria. And that's why vivax is adapted to living in colder climates than falciparum, falciparum being almost exclusively tropical because it can't tolerate winters. So the thing that you need to know is despite all these 5 species, chances are if you get malaria, it's going to be falciparum or vivax, okay? And vivax is the relapsing type. I should mention there's a little-known type called Knowlesii, which is in Southeast Asia. It's a primate malaria that we've discovered only relatively recently. It's found in monkeys and in places like Cambodia. And this acts very much like falciparum. This is the other malaria that can kill you. But it represents a very small fraction of the world's malaria burden. So if you're working in Southeast Asia, you may want to worry about Knowlesii. This is your enemy, the female Anopheles mosquito. It's only the females that feed on human beings. They need your blood to be able to lay eggs. So they're doing it for what's to them a good cause, the procreation of the species. And you can tell the Anopheles from the other mosquitoes, like Aedes, because it, when it is resting on you, preparing to bite, it has a head-down posture. It's tilted. Whereas most mosquitoes, their back is horizontal with your skin surface. The Anopheles is tilted down. Its larvae, if you happen to go down to the water source near where you're staying overseas and you find mosquito larvae, instead of hanging down from their tails like regular mosquito larvae, they tend to be horizontal with the surface. So the larvae are horizontal and the adults are vertical. And it's just vice versa with the non-anopheline mosquitoes. The eggs also do not occur in rafts. They're laid singly. So there are ways that you can easily see if you're dealing with an Anopheles mosquito. And these mosquitoes do occur in the U.S., as the recent Florida outbreak and non-travelers indicated to us. All it takes is for somebody to get off a plane who's carrying the disease, who gets bitten by our native Anopheles mosquitoes, to spread it to people who have not traveled. And this is where it breeds. The Stephensii can breed in these little pots and tires, trash that's left out in most urban slums. But it also breeds in still, stagnant water. And I was working with a project in Kinshasa, and the row of houses that we were in were death traps for malaria, because there was a ditch like this one here in front of the houses that was clogged with trash. And I went, and I heard that three people had come down last week in these houses with malaria, falciparum malaria, which got my attention because I had some students there and I was going to be living there too. So I went down there and we looked at the larvae, and they were anopheline larvae. So the main objective was to see what we could do to unclog this ditch. And the men who were there were not eager to do it. They said it's the government's job. Well, basically the response is, when was the last time the government ever cleaned out your ditch? It was just clogged with garbage, basically. And I wasn't able to convince them to do that, but a lab tech who worked with me, who was fluent in French, got them to do it. She just badgered them. And they spent a morning getting their shovels out and cleaning out that ditch, and they drained the water out. And the malaria epidemic stopped right there. So that's an example of one thing that you could do to protect yourself. If there's a pool of stagnant water around where you and your family are staying, by all means, drain that, if you can at all do so, or interrupt the breeding cycle of the mosquitoes, because they don't fly that far to infect you. Anopheles gambii is the classic African vector, but again, it's been usually a rural species of malaria. It occurs in the countryside. This Anopheles stephensii is causing urban malaria outbreaks all over Africa right now, and is probably one of our biggest setbacks in malaria control, because it's urban adapted and 40% of Africans now live in urban centers and become vulnerable to this new scourge. This species bites both indoors and outdoors, and it's very resistant to several classes of insecticides. It's a super mosquito from a malaria standpoint. Okay. The other thing you should know about Anopheles mosquitoes is that they're silent flyers. And, you know, you can usually tell when there's a mosquito in your room because of the annoying buzz that you hear. With Anopheles, don't expect to hear that buzz. This one will get you when you least expect it. So Plasmodium falciparum, getting back to the malaria species, is 40% of world malaria. It's mostly in tropical areas like lowland Africa. It is invariably chloroquine resistant now. I mean, it's the only areas where you can use chloroquine for prophylaxis might be in Central America, in the very few areas that still have malaria there. Elsewhere, chloroquine is essentially a passe drug when it comes to malaria prophylaxis or treatment. As a matter of fact, in much of Africa, including Kenya, it is illegal to sell chloroquine because people were selling it and people were giving it to their kids, and their kids were dying. It was a useless medication. Plasmodium vivax is about 50% of world malaria. It's adapted to temperate areas of the world or higher altitude areas. Some places like India are about half and half, vivax and falciparum. It is developing chloroquine resistance in Papua New Guinea and Indonesia, and that resistance is spreading. But by far, it's by far more sensitive than the falciparum malaria. The other types of malaria here are less common, so I'm not going to focus on those. Plasmodium falciparum is deadly because it can infect all ages of your red blood cells. In other words, all of your red cells are vulnerable to infection, and they're usually heavy infections with multiple ring forms or trophozoites per red cell. The trophozoite is the stage that is feeding on your hemoglobin that causes the damage. And it gets its name falciparum because it, some of the gametocytes, the sexual stage that is drawn up into the mosquito and breeds, are sickle-shaped or falciform. So not all, only are all ages of red cells affected and you have heavy infections, but you also get these knob formations that occur on the red cells. The red cells become bumpy or irregular when they're infected with the malaria inside, and that causes them to clog up in your capillaries, the capillaries of your brain, the capillaries of your kidney. And these cause the dreaded complications of falciparum malaria that are so often fatal. Cerebral malaria, if it's your brain, and black water fever, if it's your kidneys. And it can basically shut down your brain or your kidneys very quickly if you're not immune to falciparum malaria. We had an African graduate student at West Virginia University who grew up in Nigeria, and he went back to visit family, didn't take prophylaxis, didn't think he needed it because he grew up in Africa. Everybody assumes that if you grow up there, you have partial immunity to malaria from having it during childhood. You know, a large number of African children die before the age of 5, but the survivors are more likely to live because they have partial immunity. But that partial immunity depends on constantly being bitten by mosquitoes carrying malaria. And you still get sick, but it's a much milder form of the disease after you've developed this. But he went back and he had lost his immunity, but didn't realize it. And he died of cerebral malaria very quickly, an unnecessary death that easily could have been prevented. So when we go to a place like Africa, or a highly malarious country, and assume we're going to be okay because we can develop native resistance after a few bites, you're like an African infant that gets bitten, and chances are very good that you might die with your first malaria infection if you're unlucky enough to get falciparum malaria. And so that's a big deal. Vivax malaria is called a benign malaria compared to the malignant malaria, which is the old term for the falciparum malaria. This type of malaria only infects, there's only one trophozoite or ring cell per red cell, which is a way of distinguishing it under the microscope. And also, you can sometimes see these amoeboid trophozoites before they split apart. And this is the one that persists in the liver and can cause recurrent infections over and over again, unless you get a separate treatment to eradicate the disease in your liver. Now, the symptoms of malaria, so you recognize them, but think of headache and flu-like symptoms. You've got that myalgia feeling, the aching of muscles, and the headache you get with malaise. You think you're coming down with the flu, and that's the prodrome of malaria. And then as these red cells burst and release all the merozoites that become infect new red cells and infect other cells, you get paroxysms of rigor, they're called. And rigor is shaking chills. So shaking chills are another classic sign of malaria, usually with sweating. And then you may have a short respite period, and then you get another attack of this. And these different malarias have different periodicities of fever. So tertian malaria, which is both the pattern in falciparum and vivax and ovale, is every 48 hours. Okay, it got its name tertian because this is one refers to the day-night cycle, which is more frequent than the 48-hour cycle. But I don't want you to think that periodicity is something that you should expect early on in an infection with malaria. It develops later on if you're lucky enough to survive the first week of infection. And as I said, you often can't. Splenomegaly, anemia often occur. You can become jaundiced due to hemolysis of the blood. You often become delirious as well. Now, the complications of falciparum malaria, I mentioned the cerebral malaria, black water fever, when the kidneys are infected. Those things are often fatal. There's pulmonary edema with acute shortness of breath. There's something called algid malaria, where you go into circulatory shock with hypothermia. All of these are ways in which falciparum malaria can easily kill a non-immune individual. So I'm hoping to put the fear of God into you regarding malaria. It's not just another disease, that you could brush off. And again, this is a summary of why falciparum is such a bad disease to get. Now, this is the brain of somebody who died of cerebral malaria. You can see that all the capillaries are clotted off. So this is your brain on malaria, or malaria on your brain, if you prefer. But you don't want this to happen to you. So before you go overseas to a country that has endemic malaria, you want to ask, is there significant malaria risk where I'm going? It could be that the country you're going to had malaria risk, but it was 20 years ago, and the risk is negligible right now. But it could also be that it's a country, like many countries in lowland Africa, particularly West Africa, where the whole country is at risk for malaria the year round. What type is likely to be present? If it's mostly vivax, well, you can sometimes get by without prophylaxis. You might get sick, but you're not likely to die. But if it's falciparum malaria, like it's likely to be in Africa or Papua New Guinea, in tropical areas, then you're risking your life to really go bare. In some cases, it's both types of malaria. Is this risk year-round or seasonal where I'm going? So many parts of the world, like Zimbabwe, if you're in Harare, which is high veld, it's called, a high plateau, it's cooler there, and there's really no falciparum malaria. I mean, people come in and develop symptoms there from the lowlands because people travel. But if you're living in Harare, you're not likely to get fatal malaria at all. In the low veld, where I did some work with students at Mount Darwin, at Karanda Hospital, there's a peak malaria season that pretty much runs March, April, and May. And this is true in much of the world, where there's a distinct rainy season. It's at the end of the rainy season when things are drying up, pools are becoming stagnant, that provides the ideal time for mosquitoes to breed. And that's when your mosquito population will exponentially increase, and you'll have a scourge of malaria for 2 or 3 months. And then that water dries up, the riverbeds dry up, and the malaria breeding stops for another year until the next rains come. Now, at the beginning of the rainy season, the water is flowing, and it's harder for the mosquitoes to reproduce. So, clearly, there, you just need prophylaxis in the low veld for 3 months, and then you can depend on vigilance and self-treatment for the remainder of the year. If you're living in a low area like Victoria Falls, you're in an area where transmission occurs year-round of falciparum malaria, and you're pretty much obligated to take prophylaxis year-round. So this means that some people can get by with long-term prophylaxis, other people can manage with short-term. And a lot of what you do can, in terms of protecting yourself, can also be non-pharmacologic. So at Karanda, you know, a lot of people would come in for a hernia repair and end up going home with malaria because the hospital was built right over, right next to the river, which was full of malaria, anopheline larvae. And so if there was a way of stopping malaria near the hospital, you could pretty much stop the nosocomial malaria that we were being plagued with in the hospital by draining those pools or spraying them. But we insisted that everybody who was admitted to the hospital use bed nets. Half did, and it was hard to enforce because it was often hot inside. The am I near a medical facility where I can get rapid diagnosis and treatment if I do catch malaria? And so basically, if you're more than 24 hours away, you may want to have a rapid diagnostic test because there's nobody there to do a blood smear and look at it under a microscope. But a rapid diagnostic test is a very quick way. It's like your COVID test that we're all familiar with now. Same thing. And they have fairly inexpensive tests that can not only identify if you've got malaria, if this fever is malaria, but even whether it's vivax or falciparum malaria, depending on where the lines are. So in that case, you can use self-treatment in a lower risk area. You can ask, what are my colleagues using? And often the answer is nothing. I've done surveys at mission hospitals around the world where I've taken my students. And, you know, at Karanda, people were getting together once a week to drink papaya leaf tea, which was intensely bitter, tasted like quinine. So obviously it must work like quinine to reduce your risk. But there was no evidence that it really was all that effective. It was sort of a placebo, I think, that people believed in. But you know the original gin and tonic, the use of quinine or bitters, was how the British tried to protect themselves against malaria, you know, when they were serving overseas. Unfortunately, the amount of quinine used would be insufficient to protect against malaria. And if you put a sufficient amount in your drink, you would probably not want to drink it. Okay, it's that bitter. Can I develop malaria resistant like the natives? Only if you feel very, very lucky, okay? Because, I mean, if you're willing to accept a 50% chance that you might die during that first week, and if you're lucky enough to survive the initial spells, you may become partially resistant to malaria. Okay, so where are you going to be at risk? Sub-Saharan Africa, especially West Africa, is the area of greatest risk. So if you're going to Gabon, for instance, you're going to need to be on prophylaxis year-round or you're going to be risking your life. In East Africa, it's very different. If you're at high altitude in Kenya, over 5,000 feet, you may not need malaria prophylaxis. You can depend on self-treatment, self-diagnosis, because the risk is low. Where you're going to catch malaria is when you go on a beach holiday near Mombasa, and you're going to go to low altitude. But people do travel. You're not going to probably stay at that one site your whole time. So if you go to low altitude areas, your risk increases. And indeed, you may we may find that with climate change, the malaria, the falciparum malaria, is creeping up. So, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 feet used to be safe. Now it's not. In mountainous areas like Papua New Guinea, they're seeing it at higher and higher altitudes because climate is changing, and that seems to be favoring the vectors of malaria and dengue, anything that's mosquito-borne. So you also need to know that These Anopheles mosquitoes only feed after dusk, so it's between dusk and dawn that is your chief period of risk. So if you're going to be on a tour and you're going to be in an air-conditioned, you're going through a malarious area, but you're going to be in an air-conditioned hotel, not outside, in the, this is what I call the Western cocoon that we bring with us because of our wealth. We can, and you're not planning on going outside to a, you know, a camp meeting or something after dark. Your risk of getting malaria, if you're not going out in the evening and you're in a mosquito-proof dwelling, is very, very low. And of course, we talked about seasonal exposure. Are you familiar with the CDC Yellow Book? There's an edition 2024 that's coming out. That has a list of countries that have malaria. It's a very good resource. You can check on cdc.gov. There's also a Malaria Atlas project that tries to map out areas at risk in different countries for malaria. And what we used in our travel clinic, I'm not trying to push this service because it requires a hefty subscription fee of about $90-some dollars a year, but this was Shoreland's Travax, and they give you malaria maps for different countries showing areas at risk. This is one for India. It's from about probably 5 years ago, so it's no longer accurate, but because these maps change with time. But from this map, you can see that the risk of getting malaria in India is negligible if you're going to the south of India, say the Kerala state. Now, there's an epidemic of Nipah virus that's killing people in Kerala right now, but your risk of getting malaria is quite low there. It's if you go to North India, especially towards the end of the monsoon, that your risk peaks. And it's a mixture of falciparum and vivax. The cities that they have in black are the ones that carry the risk of malaria, and the cities that are white, have white circles, have much lower risk. So this gives you a much better idea of targeting, you know, what your risk is going to be, rather than taking prophylaxis for every. Most travel doctors that you'll go to, they'll prescribe prophylaxis if you're going to India, whether you're going to the south or the north, regardless of the season of the year. You know, if you're going in February, you know, before the monsoon starts in India, pretty much anywhere, your risk is going to be pretty low, okay? And if you're going in the monsoon period, which is after May during the summer months, your risk increases in the north, all right? And in lowland areas of the north, you can see that in the Himalayas, you know, the risk is actually pretty low too. So it just gives you an idea that climate and geography are really everything when it comes to malaria. What are some of the non-pharmacologic ways I can protect myself? Well, permethrin-treated bed nets are fantastic, especially if you have small children who can't take malaria prophylaxis. And pregnant women, by the way, are super attractive to mosquitoes and need this protection. But I recommend treated bed nets for everybody, and you should sleep under them unless you've got a, you know, full-fledged air conditioning and good window screens, which in Africa are actually a rarity. Most of the places that I went to did not have that, were insufferably hot. You had to open the windows to be able to breathe in the room, and so you depended upon bed nets for your entire protection. A lot of the bed nets have holes in them, which is where the permethrin treatment is pretty important. We talked about vector control, draining the swamp, basically. Residual spraying of the interior can do a lot because a lot of these mosquitoes rest on the wall during the day, hiding under picture frames, and then they emerge at night silently. They don't buzz to feed on you, and you don't even know that they're there. So if they spray down your walls, that can help. Wear full-sleeve protective clothing if you can. Of course, that's not sometimes practical due to heat. Use intermittent prophylaxis for some native populations like pregnant women and children, often with something called sulfadoxine pyrimethamine. And if you work overseas, you may be familiar with that. They have what's called perennial, malaria chemoprophylaxis, or PMC, for children, native children, where they give three doses of this SP preparation, which, by the way, has widespread resistance. But it seems to knock down the malaria mortality sufficiently that it's still very useful. You know, we had a program where we would, at WVU, where we would take kids with heart defects from Africa, and we would put them through surgeries that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to give them new heart plumbing, basically. And some of these kids, when we sent them back to Africa, they would die within a month from malaria, just like their unprotected colleagues. But you sort of want to protect an investment like that instead of seeing them just die from common malaria when they go back. And so putting these kids on prophylaxis is a good idea. But this is not the type of prophylaxis that you would be recommended for you or your family. It's for the local population. And it's the local population that's getting this R21 vaccine. Getting a artemisinin combination therapy, or ACT therapy, for sick kids in homes of mothers where they can give, you know, when kids get a high fever, seem to have malaria, and they're pretty good at recognizing malaria given the fact that they've lived with it. That can be life-saving for these children to have the therapy in the mom's medicine chest. And have any of you heard of the Bohemia Project? This is still largely experimental, but we know that giving ivermectin, not for COVID, which doesn't work, but giving populations ivermectin, it's actually an internal insecticide. So when the mosquitoes bite you, they die because they drop the ivermectin with it, and ivermectin is actually pretty safe. So this is being used experimentally once a month for 3 months during the end of the rainy season, during that period of peak vulnerability, to pretty much wipe out the mosquitoes, and it's proven to be pretty effective. So it's not something that's ready for prime time. I'm not recommending you buy ivermectin to take with you, but it does seem to be able to work. So use your bed nets. Here's an example of that. Unfortunately, a lot of these bed nets have been repurposed as fishing nets or other things, and or the men take them and sell them in the market for more money to buy booze, and leaving their families unprotected against malaria. So they have to be used. To diagnose malaria, we use blood smears to identify the species, basically, but point-of-care testing, this chromatography, there's a Binax now and other brands of this, will give you a quick, rapid self-diagnosis of malaria that's affordable. Okay? And if you do take blood smears, it's best done when somebody is febrile, and repeat negative smears if your suspicion is high, because the initial smear, if taken during a non-febrile period, can sometimes be give you a false negative. These rapid diagnostic tests tend to stay positive for several weeks after you get malaria, so there are no use in following the patient's course. You have to use blood smears to see response to treatment. But they're pretty sensitive and specific, and they're useful. This is an example of one. And here's some examples of what the test results might look like. Okay, this is what a thin film and a thick film blood smear is like. They use thick films in Africa because the only, you know, much of the malaria is falciparum. They're not worried about speciation of the malaria. They're just wanting to know if malaria is present or not. But if you use thin films, you can actually determine the species by the morphology, the number of rings per red cell, and so on. Well, let's talk quickly about some of the common malaria medications. I mentioned chloroquine is no longer recommended outside of Central America, either for treatment or prophylaxis, unless you know you're dealing with Vivax. Quinine and doxycycline, given in combination, used to be a pretty popular regimen, and it's very effective. But unfortunately, quinine is rather hard to tolerate, and after 7 days, after a few days of it, your ears start ringing from the quinine. And if you keep taking it afterwards, you can actually lose your hearing, mostly temporarily, but there have been cases where it's been permanently damaged. So a lot of people have to stop taking quinine before the full 7 days is out. A drug that has really come to the fore, and which was my go-to drug whenever I was prescribing malaria for malaria prophylaxis for short-term fix, would be atovaquone proguanil, better known by its brand name as Malarone. And that's an oral drug. It can be used for prophylaxis, but it's taken daily. And it can also be used for treatment. However, if you come down with malaria symptoms while you're taking Malarone for prevention, you'd want to choose something else for treatment, obviously. There's Artemether lumefantrine, better known by its name Coartem. In Europe, it's marketed as Reumet. This is approved in the United States. It's an oral tablet. It's not a good prophylactic agent, but it is a good self-treatment agent. And you'll see this in little boxes that are very affordable all over Africa that you can buy for the self-treatment of malaria. I recommend that you pick some of those up if you are overseas and bring some back with you in case you get malaria symptoms so you would have enough to treat yourself with. In the event that you had trouble finding a physician diagnosis, it's also much, much more expensive to buy in this country. Artesinate is the IV form of artemisinin. Artemisinin is a derivative of the sweet Annie wormwood, which is a natural Chinese herb that's naturalized in America now. And it was actually one of the old traditional Chinese remedies for summer heat. Summer heat was fever during the summer months. Guess what that usually was in ancient China? It was malaria. And they actually did testing of this and found it to be extremely effective as quickly knocking out falciparum malaria. Unfortunately, if you use it by itself, you can get resistance. So they usually combine it with a longer-acting drug that mops up any surviving malaria and prevents resistance from developing. And that is the lumefantrine that's in combination here. This is an example of artemisinin combination therapy. Do not use artemisinin for prophylaxis, though, because it's only in the bloodstream for a short period of time. It's very effective during that short time, but it's not going to be lingering in your blood long enough to protect you. Then there's mefloquine. Have any of you heard scary stories about mefloquine? See a few hands. This is notorious for possible neuropsychiatric side effects. And unfortunately, we're seeing resistance to it in Southeast Asia. Much of Southeast Asia has falciparum malaria that's resistant to mefloquine now. However, I will put in a plug for it in a moment, because if you're going to be serving long-term overseas, it's a weekly drug that's convenient to take. And for people who can take it, it's a wonderful solution to a long-term problem. Much easier than taking doxycycline for prophylaxis every day, which can upset your stomach and cause increased sensitivity to the sun. I'll talk about the being crazy part later. Primaquine. We use primaquine primarily for eradication of the hypnozoites in treating vivax malaria. It's been used as prophylaxis in some areas where there's only vivax, but it's not your prophylactic agent of choice for Africa. And it also has the propensity of causing hemolysis if you have G6PD deficiency. So we always test people to see if they have this enzymatic deficiency before we give it to them. That's more people who have Greek and Mediterranean ancestry. People with Asian or African ancestry are at greater risk. But you can't tell, because many people with the last name of Thompson in West Virginia would have an Italian grandfather, okay, or a Greek parent. You know, their mother was Greek. And so a surname doesn't give you enough evidence to assume that they don't have the gene. Primaquine is being replaced by tafenoquine, which is a single oral dose of 200-300 milligram tablets, and it was approved by the FDA in 2020, and this eradicates the hypnozoite, and it's a much easier, much quicker approach. Unfortunately, it still has that problem of causing G6PD deficient hemolysis, and you have to avoid it in pregnancy. It does not work in Southeast Asia. It was originally just the Thai Burma border area, but it has now spread so that I wouldn't use it in the Southeast Asia region. So here are some of the prophylactic agents you might be given. If you're going to an area in Honduras that still has malaria, they might give you chloroquine. You take it weekly, start it the week before you go, once a week while you're there, and for 4 weeks after you come back. The 4 weeks after you come back is called the tail, the end part. And this is where a lot of best laid plans go awry, because a lot of people figure, once I'm out of country, I'm out of risk. But they stop taking the drug too soon, and they can still get malaria. Doxycycline is every day. You can't use it in kids under 8 because of the teeth staining. You can't use it in pregnant women. And it can be hard on a lot of people's stomach, but if you take it with plenty of water and you don't lie down for a half hour, most people can do very well with it. Use some sunscreen if you've got light skin. And you have to take it daily and for 4 weeks after you come back. I'm talking about 28 days, which gives you other compliance issues, especially if they forget to take it with a full glass of water and they get the esophagitis that doxycycline has sometimes caused in me. And I can promise you, after getting that, they won't take doxycycline again. And so you've derailed your prophylaxis. Mefloquine is once a week like chloroquine. Like chloroquine, it can lower the seizure threshold. And so it's contraindicated in people with epilepsy. And even in people without epilepsy, there was one guy who mistook his, you know, thought he had to take the mefloquine daily instead of weekly. He got the wrong advice, and he ended up having a seizure, his first seizure, because of this drug. Interestingly, chloroquine and mefloquine are pregnancy category B. These are the drugs that are considered safe in pregnancy, despite all you've heard about mefloquine. And again, don't use mefloquine in Southeast Asia. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the psychiatric issues. The last one is the Malarone or Etobicoke Proguanil. This is taken daily. It's safe in breastfeeding and for infants who are 5 kilograms or greater. And there are pediatric doses, which are 1/4 of the adult dose, which makes pediatric dosing easy. But it's taken daily during your time of exposure and for 7 days after you return or leave the malaria risk area. So this is the best drug for short-term travel. It's expensive, however, even though it's available now as a generic, and that limits our use of that. And so what about mefloquine? It's a reasonable option still for long-term expats in high-risk areas. It's seldom my first choice. There's a 2013 black box warning put on mefloquine that says that it can cause permanent neurologic and psychiatric damage. And the military has almost stopped using it for that reason, because people have used it in criminal defense trials after coming back and killing their wife. It's been shown in most cases that that's not been the cause of the problem, but and in my experience, it can cause short-term psychiatric problems, but not long-term or permanent ones. There was one physician I traveled with who elected to take mefloquine, and he became convinced, for reasons unknown only to him, that he would catch HIV from the shower water. And this was a guy with an MD, okay. So he stopped taking showers. much to the rest of the team's dismay. But he would have a panic attack every time he went into the shower. So when he came back and he went off the mefloquine, that fear went away. Okay. So I screen everybody for a pre-existing psychiatric history. Have you had panic attacks, bipolar disorder, chronic depression, of course seizures? Fact is that most people, if you screen out the people with a pre-existing psychiatric history, can do okay on it. Those who can't, usually it's the first three doses, three weekly doses, will reveal if they have a problem. So this is one where I always give people a test series of doses before they fly. So somebody's going to go to Toronto here. You all put them on mefloquine for 3 weeks, before they go. Are they getting a little skitsy? Are they behaving strangely? Are they having panic attacks? If so, we find another prophylactic agent for them rather than having them have this in the field. Most of the cases where people have psychiatric reactions in the field aren't due to their malaria prophylaxis. It's due to culture shock. The fact that you're in a totally strange culture can also cause panic attacks, depression. So the water is very muddy when you come to these drugs. We know that it can make you crazy, though, because if you take a full treatment dose, which is 5 tablets in a day or 3 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon, a lot of those people become a little bit unbalanced for a few days. So it's a dose effect. And I always test people before they go. The one thing that I experienced with mefloquine is very vivid dreams. Not nightmares. Some people have nightmares. But my dreams were just extremely lifelike and vivid. And I think a lot of people have those. The chances are that every time you take mefloquine, you're going to have the same thing repeat itself. So if you can take it for a month and not have any adverse effects, you're probably mefloquine proven, and it's probably a good choice for you, especially if you're planning on getting pregnant on the field, because it's our only Category B anti-malarial. You want to take it the same day each week with food and water. It can also upset your stomach. And always be aware that you can have dizziness, sometimes ringing of the ears with it as well. If you're pregnant, and there are a number of women of childbearing age with children in here, the CDC recommendation is to delay or avoid travel until your pregnancy is over. That's always not always practical for people. You want to also try to wait till your newborn infant is safe enough for safe prophylaxis, weighs enough for safe prophylaxis, 5 kilograms or more. If you can't, use an insecticide-treated bed net over the crib, every night when that baby is sleeping, so the mosquitoes don't feed on your baby. Again, mefloquine remains the prophylactic drug of choice for chloroquine-resistant areas, except for Southeast Asia. Okay. And people with psychiatric histories. Doxycycline is contraindicated. Tafenoquine and primaquine are contraindicated for pregnant women because you can't test the fetus for G6PD deficiency. The fetus may be deficient and the mother may not be, which means that the drug could kill the fetus in that scenario. Etobicoke, proguanil, some people have said, well, let's go ahead and use it in pregnancy. Proguanil is a folate antagonist, so you certainly don't want to use it in the first trimester, but after which you could use folic acid 5 milligrams a day if it's the only available option, and that supplement might get you around that issue. But that's considered class C, using the old pregnancy classifications. If you need treatment for malaria and you're pregnant, use quinine and clindamycin. That's the approved treatment for pregnant women. Okay? And, of course, the native prophylaxis is totally different. So what about self-treatment if you're in an area that's low risk and you decide to go without prophylaxis, but you've got your point of care test, and you test yourself when you get fever, and it's a positive test. Well, you can pull out a treatment dose of Malarone and take 4 tablets a day for 3 days, and that will cure uncomplicated malaria. And or you could use Coartem, and it takes 24 tablets of that, 4 tablets at the start, 4 more at 8, 24, 36, and 48 hours, and 60 hours. It's a long course, more complicated than the Malarone, but it's available in most countries very inexpensively. So those are the two go-to treatments. And Mefloquine can be used as a go-to treatment too. However, you're likely to be crazy for a while. Okay? So mild malaria, give Coartem Malarone. Moderate, an artemisinin and combination therapy is probably best, but Coartem is one of those. Severe malaria, where you have to use IV drugs, we found out that IV artesunate, that formulation of the wormwood, is actually much better than IV quinine, which we used to use in terms of effectiveness. If you can't get an IV, you can use rectal artemether in very severe disease. Artemether is another formulation of the same drug. So this gives you some more information. Again, if you're in Europe, Riamet is a European brand. Coartem in the U.S. costs about $150 for a 24-tablet course, which is somewhat pricey. It's probably about $5 or less overseas. Okay, that's why I suggested picking some up abroad. Okay, but it's very effective. It can be used in young kids. It's not yet approved in pregnancy, although some people have used it in pregnancy. And this is an example of what you might buy in the store, this little yellow and white box. Malarone is the old atovaquone-proguanil combination. It can be used as treatment or prophylaxis, according to these regimens. And it is expensive, although the cost has come down. It's an excellent option for children. It's likely to cost you, over $100 in the United States, but I saw with GoodRx for about $50, you can get a treatment course of the Malarone now at some pharmacies. So remember that visiting friends and relatives traveler, the guy from West Virginia who was going back to visit his family after getting his PhD and died in Africa during that visit. Those are one of the highest risk travelers because they don't think about taking prophylaxis. They don't consult a travel medicine specialist. And then travelers to Africa are at high risk, and that includes missionary travelers. And a lot of people who decide to go bare are really fooling themselves when it comes to... So use repellents, just to summarize here. Reduce your mosquito bites with bed nets, window screens. Take your prophylaxis as directed when at risk, even if it's for part the peak portion of your risk per year. And then you can depend on self-treatment and self-diagnosis during the remainder. Or if you're working in a hospital, you can get blood smears be diagnosed. When you go back home, always give your doctor a travel history so they think about malaria. And this is within a year of returning home. Any febrile illness within 3 months of return could be falciparum. And Vivax can take up to a year sometimes to manifest the symptoms. You're not allowed to donate blood for a year after returning from a visit to a malarious area. And if you live in that area for a more extended period of time, you're not allowed to donate blood for 3 years. The minimum incubation time between mosquito bite and symptoms is 1 week. So be aware of the risk at your destination. B, avoid being bitten. C, take your chemoprophylaxis or your malaria prevention pills if they're needed in your area. And D, immediately seek diagnosis and treatment if your fever develops. Developing natural immunity to malaria is impractical. Pregnancy lessens that immunity even if you had it. HIV worsens malaria and vice versa. Sickle cell and thalassemia provide a little bit of protection against severe malaria, but certainly no immunity. And there's no effective malaria vaccine for you as a traveler right now. So here is some bottom line advice. Having the POC point of care test and having Coartem or Malarone for self-treatment is always a good idea. And bring it home with you. Do not risk getting malaria if you can help it. And this talks a little bit of, you know, in Papua New Guinea, long-term missionaries there were giving blue turtle pharmaceuticals, homeopathic anti-malarials to their kids for malaria protection. Well, you know what homeopathy is? Extreme dilutions or succussions of something that prevents malaria, but you're essentially giving them an inert substance that is unlikely to prevent malaria in any way. And they're taking a tremendous risk with their family. We want to keep missionaries on the field and productive on the field, not sick all the time, or worse yet, going home in a coffin, which is how a lot of missionaries went home, or they actually were buried in country. But the number of missionaries who died of malaria in the 19th century and the early 20th century is mind-boggling. Okay. If you get this PowerPoint, there are some hotlines from the CDC that are useful and some websites that are useful. I've got some references and some study questions here, which we don't have time for. But I hope we do have time for a question or two. If any of you have questions, feel free to ask them. Yes?
How do we get the presentation again?
I am not familiar with the details, but I'm assuming that the PowerPoints will be made available to the participants, and you'll have access to this. And that's a big assumption. Yes?
For long-termers who've already had malaria, is there any period of time where they don't need to take prophylaxis, or is it?
Not really. It's sort of like getting COVID. People say, well, if I've had COVID, I'm immune. Well, you are for maybe a few months, and then you can get it again. And I know that the hard way. And so the answer is it's not a full immunity even right afterwards. It's a partial resistance. And so, yes, you're less likely to get a severe case for the next few months, but that immunity is going to wane. And it's, you know, like Israel before the Babylonian exile, trusting in Egypt to deliver it. It's not going to happen. To use a biblical analogy. Yes?
I've been disturbed over the past couple of years to get two very incorrect malaria prophylaxis prescriptions from primary care physicians in my area. Not for me personally, but for other people. So it's a fluid enough area that I always check. And anyone can just check on the CDC website. It's not hard at all.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention that. Particularly like as I'm asked to give advice to a group of mission travelers, you know, they will just take the word of their primary care doctor without kind of questioning it. I am a primary care doctor, so I don't mean to...
I am too, and I don't mean to disparage them, but most primary care doctors know diddly squat about malaria and also malaria prophylaxis. Unfortunately, it's not something they do every day. And so you can go to a travel clinic. The CDC has a website where they have travel clinics, people who know a little bit more. But you could also check with the CDC to make sure the prophylaxis you were given is appropriate. I mentioned that one guy who was given a prescription for mefloquine daily. That's not practice, basically. It caused him to have a seizure. It's a weekly drug. And I would sit around in the local bar with expatriates from Germany and all sorts of places and ask them what their prophylaxis agents were. And you wouldn't believe the answers that I got, the crazy things that they had been put on. Yes?
So I just wanted to comment, too. You mentioned the sun sensitivity with doxycycline if you're fair-skinned, but just a warning,
It has nothing to do with skin color.
Yeah.
If you're taking doxycycline, my husband is one of those blessed with dark skin. He was listening to me. We were in Ecuador. He experienced his first sunburn ever. And I wasn't very sympathetic.
Well, you know, of course, fair-skinned people are more sensitive to the sun to begin with. However, blacks on doxycycline, apparently it increases the likelihood of a UV reaction. And they can get black people can get a nasty burn on doxycycline sometimes as well. It doesn't seem to bother me as much as the GI side effects do, despite being fairly fair-skinned myself. And so some people are much more susceptible to it than others. And other people, I think you were an example, you were in Gabon and took doxycycline for how many years?
Between 15 and 20, and all of our family did too.
Right.
Yeah.
So as long as your children are over 8 and none of them are pregnant, you can do it.
And we didn't have any problems with sunburn either, but we have fair skin. So it's funny who it affects.
Some people, I think there's an innate susceptibility, like there is with mefloquine for a psychiatric disturbance, yes.
We also used doxycycline in Kenya when we would go to the coast when our kids were over 8 and they both have red hair. And so we were very circumspect with the sunscreen and with when we took it, with food and water, and for 4 weeks afterward, and nobody got sick.
Yes.
So we were circumspect.
The cases, I've seen a lot of cases, I treated a lot of malaria and returning travelers as well, because I directed an international travel clinic. But invariably, these were either VFR travelers who didn't take anything or people who never finished. They got home and they stopped taking their prophylaxis after they got back. I also have a red-haired son and a red-haired granddaughter, and so I'm familiar with that problem. It's a real problem if you take your family overseas and they're redheads, because they'll burn through a T-shirt. Anybody else? Yes.
Just a comment as well, and I have personally used and referred my patients to a place called Passport Health.
Mm-hmm.
Heard of them? There's one in Cincinnati and one in Lexington.
They are one of our competitors. Yeah.
See, they do a great job. That's all they do.
That's all they do, and so they know how to do it. Yeah. Whereas your primary care doctor may not have done this before, and most of them can do a passable job if they take the time to go onto the CDC site, look up the recommended dose, but they're not going to give you the nuance that a Passport Health or other travel clinic doctor would, who has access to those maps. In other words, they'll use the Procrustean bed approach. You're probably familiar, this is a mythology thing, but there used to be a giant who operated a notorious inn near Athens, and he had one-sized bed. And one size would fit all. If you were too long for the bed, he would chop your legs off. If you were too short, he would put you on a rack and stretch you out. And that's the approach that a lot of people use for travel medicine. They'll give you you're going to India, well, I'm going to put you on Malaram. But you might be going to Kerala State in the south during the January to February period where there's essentially no risk anywhere in India. And there's no need for you to take prophylaxis then. But that nuance comes with either having been there yourself or having access to the maps that give you that information. Do you want to share a little bit about, I'd like you to share about some of your close calls that you had at your mission center.
Well, we did have a few, even had one of our physicians who decided she had grown up in Gabon, and so she thought she had resistance. And but she stayed in her house, and she had screens on her house, and she didn't go down to the village very often. She was always in the hospital. She came down with malaria and just about died. Had cerebral malaria, recovered. And she was with her father and her sister, and they didn't take it either. And they almost died as well. So it was really a close call. What I found, too, is that our missionary team, at least once a year, I had to remind them to kind of update their information for visitors and to be really, because, we had different people corresponding with people and inviting them and so forth, but to really, really emphasize the importance of taking is that if they weren't going to take it, don't come.
Right.
And we just had so many close calls.
So this is a perfect example. If you're in a high-risk country, it should be mandatory that people who come out, even for a short time onto the field, should take protection. You don't want this to happen on your watch. So if you're in a leadership position, you can avoid catastrophe, really. You know, there's nothing worse than, you know, a volunteer team coming out to your mission site or a physician coming out to do a rotation there and dying of malaria. And the consequences of that for their family, for everyone, and also cutting a career short, are just immeasurable when, you know, a handful of pills could have prevented it.
The other group that was hard to convince were when mothers came out with small children to get them to give those kids their medication. You know, they just didn't want to do it. And we had some close calls with that too.
Yeah, I also want to mention, I didn't mention this enough, DEET-containing insect repellent is something people are very reluctant to use now, especially mothers on their kids. But it seems to be safe, much safer than we thought it was. Don't use 100% DEET. It should be definitely below 50%, and I like the 35% sustained release DEET. But I depend on that. It's a lot more effective than the botanicals, like oil of lemon eucalyptus is the probably the best botanical out there. But your risk with oil of lemon is up here, and your risk with DEET is down here. So this is one case where it's okay to use a chemical. All right, yes.
Along those lines, I know you initially talked about permethrin for, I guess, a non-pharmacological way of going to an area.
Permethrin-treated bed nets.
Right.
Yeah, and clothing too.
Now they also make sprays like you would, like, you know, mm-hmm. like you would for off or whatever. But the sprays are like 0.5% or 1%. Is that right?
They vary in what they are, but there's a much stronger spray that you can get at places like Walmart, a permethrin solution that you can spray on. I take all the stuff that I'm going to be wearing. And I saturate it with this spray, and I let it dry in the sun, and then I pack it. And it pretty much kills insects that land on my clothing. It also keeps ticks away. In the summer, it's really great when I work out in the field. For all I know, it saved my life a number of times using this permethrin, pre-treating my clothing with permethrin. Now, I can't tell you whether or not that's going to work for Anopheles defensii, that new urban adapted mosquito that's super resistant, because some of them are resistant to permethrin now. But it's better than, you know, it's better than not using anything.
Well, okay. The question I have is, like, if you have, you know, treat a patient with lice or whatever, that's a 5% cream that you put on.
Yeah.
But for the sprays I've seen that you spray on your body, it's just like 0.5%, or, which doesn't make sense to me because you're only spraying part of your body with that, whereas
treating lice. Well, I never put the permethrin on my body directly. I put it on my clothing when I'm not wearing my clothing.
Those sprays that you're talking about, they're for treating furniture. Like if you've got lice in your home, it's designed to
spray that.
Lice on your sofa, things that can't be laundered. Yeah.
Okay. Any last questions? Thank you so much. You've been a great audience.